This week on Your Western Context, an NDP MLA crashed the UCP's vaccine website. A holiday for only some shows division between the public and private sectors, and Trudeau's inflation relief only furthers the problem. Also, Pierre Poilievre gets heckled by the media during a speech. This is Western Context, episode 286, recorded Saturday, September 17th, 2022. Hackers and Hecklers. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are back this week, and as we predicted last week, heading into September means that the news is picking up again, and as it has following the election of Pierre Poilievre as the new Conservative leader, and the reaction from the media and Justin Trudeau we'll talk about in a bit, but nonetheless, we're going to be delivering the news as we have been each and every week since January 2017.
Yes, indeed. There's lots of news this week that's kind of gone undercovered, especially due to the media deciding to focus once again on the biggest news story of the week, that being of the Queen's impending funeral. And there has been a lot of other news this week that has actually gone on in Canada that really just hasn't been reported on. And a lot of analysis has been going towards other areas, and not really much has gone towards the news that actually matters to Canadians.
That's right. And if you're joining us for the first time, Western Context is a podcast that aims to cut through all the media bias and sensationalism, and in doing so, we hope to provide all the information and context necessary to put you, our listeners, on the right side of the news. And with that, we're going to begin with our Alberta story, and if you want to follow along, you can find full show notes at westerncontext.ca. And once again, in Alberta, we're talking about a story that the media should be talking about, but as we mentioned, most of what gets talked about around the legislature at this time in particular is either regarding the Queen's impending funeral, which will be happening on Monday, or of course, the UCP leadership race, which focuses on one or two singular topics. And with this, we're going to be going back 1 year to when Alberta started rolling out its COVID vaccine record program that was used to implement the restriction exemption program, or the vaccine passports, as some people called them. And if we go back to when that system was being unveiled, there were huge delays with the website that were beyond what were deemed reasonable for effectively needing to get a single printout of your vaccine record with QR code that you could later on add to your digital device. And what we now know is that former and now independent MLA Thomas Dang, who won't be running for re-election this coming spring, actually breached the Alberta vaccine record system. And we knew he did this, we just didn't know how extensive it was or what actually happened with that, and that's why he is now sitting as an independent and left on his own the NDP caucus. But what we didn't know with this is that at the time that the NDP, including Rachel Notley, knew about the breach and what the MLA was up to. But one thing that we didn't know until this week was just how big and what huge scope and how much strain was put on the system because of the breach from this MLA. Now, in September 21, MLA Dang sent 1.78 million queries to the system using Jason Kenney's birthday, as was recently revealed in unsealed court documents. And in September 2021, this created wait times of hours as more than 50,000 plus people were put into a queue to get their vaccine record. Now, if we look at the actual court documents, what they state in full, they say that during this time, there were 3.5 million requests using the date of birth of Premier Jason Kenney and a further 1 million requests using the date of birth of Thomas Dang, an MLA from the NDP. And this flood of traffic resulted in regular users being unable to access the site to download their own records. Now, according to Dang, he was testing for vulnerabilities on the newly launched website to try and find someone's Alberta healthcare number, and in particular, the Alberta healthcare number he was looking for was that of Premier Jason Kenney. Now, with this, NDP Chief of Staff Jeremy Nolle and NDP Director of Communications Benjamin Aldrit were informed of this, which of course means that with these two very high-profile, high-ranking NDP members being informed, that Rachel Notley would have also been informed about this. It was at this time that the NDP MLAs began attacking the UCP government for implementing a system that did not work, but little did anyone know that the problems that Albertans were facing were caused by one of their own MLAs. During this time, when people were trying to access records, the amount of time needed to wait skyrocketed up and beyond 14 hours to get a simple vaccine record printout that you would then scan with your mobile device and it would store it in your device's wallet system. In November, it became clear that the government was investigating a possible privacy breach, which at the time, NDP leader Rachel Notley expressed her support in the government investigating. Now, if we look to what independent media have to say on this, the independent media on the right have made the link that Rachel Notley should have known that this was their breach, but with a public-facing system and a government as big as what we have in Alberta, it could have very well have been any other breach that the government was investigating. Fast-forwarding to this June, MLA Deng was charged under the Health Information Act for illegally attempting to access private information, and as a result of this, could face a fine of up to $200,000 if he ends up being convicted. Now we're going to do what the media doesn't do and put all this together. We knew that there was a hack and we knew that MLA Deng was involved, but what we didn't know was the scale of the attack, and it had actually been reported to senior managers within the NDP. It started to become fishy in October 2021 when then NDP MLA Deng was promoted to the role of critic for democracy and ethics. And with that, you have to wonder why the NDP might have done that when you look at this, there were at least earlier on in October, two very high-ranking people in the party who knew what Thomas Deng was up to. Now, what the UCP has to say about this, Chief Government Whip Brad Rutherford is now seeking to determine what role, if any, Rachel Notley had in the attack or what she might have known about it. And this is an important story, and this story was only covered on True North Online, which is an independent, right-leaning online news website. But because of how independent media often conducts themselves, True North included, and others as well, the NDP do not cooperate with True North and have done nothing to corroborate or shoot down the story, as they should have. Because, as we all know, at this point in time, a comment from the NDP, one way or another, could advance this story and spur other media outlets to start investigating this, which is very clearly needed at this point with having only one outlet covering this. And it's so important to have that breadth of coverage on this and have it from all sides and all angles, because with only one area covering it, this leads to more polarization in the province, and as we head into May's general election, that's going to be good for nobody.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the fact that there's only one independent news source on this topic just goes to show that there's really not much coverage on this story in the entire province and certainly not in the rest of Canada as well. But an NDP MLA or any MLA going into a government website to try and flood the server, as it were, to try and take it down to test for a security vulnerability, especially at a time when most people are trying to access their vaccine passports to be able to actually just go and do regular things. You know, this is something that's unheard of in Canada, that you just don't see this sort of sabotage from MPs or MLAs across the country. And this is more like something that you'd see from the medieval era in like the 1600s in England, where you'd see different MPs going against each other based on what side of the civil war they're on. And you know, this is something that you know, we just haven't seen in civilized Canada. And the fact that this is such an unheard of story means that the lack of media coverage on it is even more suspicious, because I think that what in any other case, if this was a UCP member that had done this, you can bet that the media, independent or otherwise, would be talking all about it. But the fact that it's an NDP MLA that is now not an MLA and or not an NDP MLA, but and pretty soon won't be an MLA at all. It's very curious as to why this story got swept under the rug.
Yeah, and we also need to underscore that when it comes to cybersecurity in particular, there are firms out there that can be contracted to do this kind of testing. And then those firms do it in accordance with law. They do it in accordance with the people who own the server, the people who own the website. So the correct action would have been for the NDP or even Thomas Dang, but probably the NDP after being informed by Thomas Dang to contact the UCP or the Alberta government and say, hey, we believe you might have some sort of security vulnerability on this website. Get a private security firm to look into this. And that would have been the way to do this. There are firms that earn millions of dollars a year doing this kind of testing for other firms. It's not as though it's some brand new thing that doesn't exist. It's not the Wild West of internet security as it was in the 1980s and the 1990s. There are ways to deal with all of this, and the very idea of acquiring private information through a server that you're not supposed to get, and even trying to breach a server, those are all crimes, and that's the big deal that needs to be talked about. And that's why, with an unsensationalized media, it would be a good way to talk to the NDP, say, what do you guys know on this? But those conversations don't happen because the media is too focused on the UCP leadership race, and the media outlet looking at this has sensationalized in the past, and as a result, the NDP doesn't want to talk to them, so Albertans aren't served. And that's why we do what we do here each and every week at Western Context. If you want to help us with that, you can check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/Western Context. And there we offer three tiers of support. Starting for as little as $2 a month, you can help us remove bias and sensationalism from the news and media. For $5 a month, you can continue to help us do that and have your name read out on the podcast if you want. And for $10 a month, you can become a Western Context insider and gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production and show notes throughout the entire week. Now, when we reach $30 a month in contributions, patrons will receive an exclusive monthly news article expanding on topical stories of the month, and this article will continue to provide the context and information you've come to expect from us. At $60 a month, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month where we reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and provide opinion on where things might be headed next. We also do have an option to make a one-time contribution as well via PayPal, which you can learn more about at westerncontext.ca/support. And with that, we're going to move on into BC and talk about the news being the singular focus on the passing of the Queen and what that's making us miss out on in BC News this week.
Yes, and as the news continues to be singularly focused on the passing of Queen Elizabeth, it's hard to not talk about a story that's not at least a little bit tangentially related to the day of her funeral, which, in case you're wondering, is this upcoming Monday. Now, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was quick to declare a national day of mourning, in other words, a holiday for federal employees. Many provinces were quick to follow, including BC, meaning that public sector employees in BC, including schools and many Crown corporations, will be closed on that day. Now, Alberta was notable in calling it a provincial day of mourning, but not a statutory holiday. Now, since the day is not considered a provincial statutory holiday in any province, which is similar to the National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, this means that private sector employees will only get the day off if their employers allow for it. Now, it's a difference between the public sector employees and the private sector employees that has many wondering exactly who gets the day off and who doesn't, and some wondering why the federal and various provincial governments took such a half measure so that only some people recognize the holiday and some don't. Now, since schools will be closed, including post-secondary institutions, many working parents are now in a short-term childcare bind because They've closed schools, but they haven't actually declared a full statutory holiday so that everybody could get the day off. Now, not all everybody has the ability to change their work schedule to accommodate the change. Part of the problem is the two-tiered nature of the holiday and the impact on healthcare workers as well. In many parts of the country, healthcare is in a crisis mode, with many patients already unable to access services without a day of closures affecting appointments. Many of them have been scheduled months in advance. Now, after 2 years of the dark times related school disruptions, some parents say that it's frustrating for families to once again to be forced to grapple with sudden closures. Judy Haven, who is a researcher with the Canadian Centre for Policy and Alternatives and a retired professor at St. Mary's University in Halifax, says that it's a charade to claim that Monday is a holiday when only the civil servants get the day off. She said, quote, "They're trying to dangle the idea that workers have more rights, and it's absolutely not true. In fact, the reverse is true, because now some parents will actually lose a day of pay because they have childcare responsibilities." Now, this is just the latest in a long line of decisions by the federal government to give preferential treatment towards the public sector. Is it any wonder, then, that a new report just released this past week shows that almost all new jobs created during the dark times of the past couple of years were in the public sector? The public sector accounted for about 86.7% of all net new jobs created since the pandemic. Now, between February 2020 and July 2022, jobs in the sector grew by 9.4%, while private sector job growth remained almost stagnant at 0.4%. Now, Ben Eisen, who is the senior fellow at the Fraser Institute and co-author of the report, said that, quote, "Many of the headline statistics surrounding the Canadian labor market appear to be encouraging at a glance, but the reality is more complicated. Canada's job creation in recent years has not been driven by private sector growth, but rather has primarily been the result of government hiring." Now, the stagnation in private sector growth was predominantly caused by the significant contraction in the number of self-employed workers. Now, despite the number of self-employed workers increasing by 34,000 in July, self-employment is still down 7.4% from pre-pandemic levels. Now, it's too early to say what is driving the drain in self-employed workers, says Tricia Williams, who is the Director of Research, Evaluation, and Knowledge Mobilization at the Future Skills Center. And she speculates that increasing opportunities in the labor market may be drawing workers away from self-employment and towards jobs at large organizations. She said, quote, "When you have lots of choices in the labor market, you might not choose to take on the personal risks associated with self-employment. Some workers may want more stability and security rather than trying to venture out on their own." However, Williams did stress that entrepreneurship and self-employment are critical parts of the economy and believes that there should be more research conducted to figure out why there's been this decline in self-employment throughout the pandemic. And she said, quote, "For a healthy social capitalist economy, we absolutely need people to have a way to create new enterprises and feel like that's a viable option and that they have the supports available to them." Now, one day late last year, in December of 2021, Justin Trudeau took to Twitter to tout his government's job creation record. He said, quote, "Thanks to your hard work and the hard work of Canadians across the country, Canada's unemployment rate is the lowest it's been since the start of the pandemic. In fact, more than 154,000 jobs were created last month, and in the COVID-19 era, more than 1 million jobs have been recovered." This is what he wrote in the tweet. Now, this tweet is entirely misleading about the damage which Ottawa and other levels of government have actually done to employment growth in the economy, using the private sector's tax dollars to choke off its growth right under its nose. As we see, job creation has slowed this summer as inflation has heated up and the Bank of Canada has dramatically raised borrowing rates. Meanwhile, a record number of jobs are actually going unfulfilled, with vacancies reaching a record high of about 137,000 in July, which is a 5% increase from the peak of the last quarter of 2021. Now, according to Statistics Canada, August's unemployment rate was 5.4%, which is up from 4.9% in July, but still lower than both the 7.1% recorded last August and the long-term average of 8.14%. Now, public sector workers not only kept their jobs, but added 2 years' credit to their pension benefits, and many even saw their wages grow during the pandemic, with January Statistics Canada figures showing that public sector employment was up by 305,000 jobs from the beginning of the pandemic, and that all 206,000 job losses that month was coming from the private sector. It's been rightly concluded that, quote, two classes of Canadians have been created, those without job security or income worries, and those whose ability to support themselves and their families depends on creating value for the enterprises that employ them. Now, another Fraser Institute report found that average public sector wages were actually more than 9% higher than those of their private sector counterparts at the outset of the pandemic. On top of wages and comprehensive benefits, 88% of government workers were covered by a pension plan, compared to fewer than 23% of private sector workers, and a higher percentage of those public sector pension plans are richer, recession-proof, and defined benefit plans. Now, exacerbating the inequality, the public sector is actually more immune to layoffs because of governments fearful of having strikes on their watch, which is notable given how many there has been in BC these past month or so. Now, the irony is that lower paid private sector workers are actually paying for the higher wages and benefits of their public sector counterparts through payroll taxes. And yet, anyone trying to access government services is likely frustrated by how long it actually takes to get anything done. Now, if you've been to a passport office recently, you'll know this to be true. It's time that the federal government is held to account for its division of Canadians and ineffective economic policies that have led to two classes of Canadians, those who get a holiday on Monday and those who do not.
And this is a perfect way of visualizing the problem in the country, and a lot of people, a lot of media don't talk about what has been happening the past 2 years when it comes to the two classes of Canadians that have been created. And when you start looking at what's actually happening in the country, this is exactly the reason that people feel the way they do. And of course, anybody who has a public sector job is not going to feel the push of inflation as much as somebody else who's working in the private sector, who might not have even had cost of living increases since 2015 or 2017, when this inflationary period actually truly began. And because of that, the media isn't supporting Canadians. They're just talking about what's happening, and nobody's really in the media anymore digging into what's actually happening with our economy. And that's why there's just so many surprised people in the media industry these days.
Yes, exactly. And the fact that this report is coming out now just goes to show that a lot of the job recovery and the job creation that was created after the pandemic recovery, all of it was public sector, and all of it was government driven, and all of it was done using tax dollars. And that's part of where a lot of the spending that the government has gone is to inflate the public service. Now, of course, some of it had to be increased, especially in healthcare, given the much greater demand on the healthcare services that had happened. But quite clearly, it hasn't really fixed the problem, as many places are still in healthcare crisis across the country, notably in BC, which has the largest proportion of seniors in Canada, but also in other parts of the country that you wouldn't expect, such as the major cities. And I think that that's something that really doesn't get covered as much, and really is not covered by the media to the regard that it should, because of how important things like healthcare are to people in day-to-day lives. And I think that that's you know, something that the report highlighted, that the public sector wages are actually getting much higher while the private sector isn't, and they're not getting more jobs. So we have to take a look at what kind of job recovery is actually happening and how things have changed since the self-inflicted lockdowns that happened back in 2020, and, you know, how things are much changed 2.5 years later. And, you know, if we look at it and see that those changes aren't for the better, we have to ask the government why that is and why they did the recovery the way they did and why exactly their policies are hurting the private sector and hurting the economy.
Yeah, and nobody has been able to successfully ask those questions yet, and we're gonna see what happens when those questions do start being asked, because we imagine that will be the case going forward in the next weeks and months. But before we dive into what happens when those questions start to be asked, we have to talk about what the federal government is trying to do to help this inflationary problem and, in effect, help the people who are working private sector jobs. And of course, as we head into the fall, we have newly elected conservative leader Pierre Poilievre setting the message and media cycle over the past week. And as a result, to try and combat that, the government has opened up the taxpayers' checkbook again. This week, the federal government announced $4.5 billion in new spending to combat inflation, which anybody who's taken a first-year economics class will be wondering where exactly that comes from. But as basic economics tells us, this kind of spending can indeed factor into inflation. And we'll hear from what some of the biggest banks in the country have to say in just a wee bit on this story. But the new spending includes a doubling of a quarterly tax credit sent to low and medium income individuals to offset the federal sales tax, and a $500 one-time top-up to the housing benefit that is provided to low-income earners to help them with rent. And there will also be $650 per year for dental care to children under 12 who do not have their own insurance, which is still far away from what the NDP requested and signed away their agency to when they signed the confidence and supply deal with the Liberals. Now, as the money was just announced, it will take time to work its way into the system, probably being spent in early 2023, which could add to the inflation we see in the first quarter of next year. CIBC chief economist Avery Shenfield said that the government is, quote, adding fuel to the inflationary fire, and summarized it by saying that by helping Chantel pay for her food or gasoline bill with a government check, you hit John with higher overall inflation and Carlos with higher mortgage payments as the Bank of Canada responds with an aggressive rate hike cycle. Now, what this then comes from is that the Bank of Canada will need to act harder on inflation, which hurts all Canadians, making the cycle worse and encouraging governments like the Trudeau NDP government to continue to act even further. Now, Scotiabank was even more critical, saying that it seems sensible to assume that this will add to the pressures that are put on of core inflation, and any belief that this will ease inflationary pressures must have been studied in different economics textbooks. And the National Post also talked about this week, this week as well, with a good rundown talking about true runaway inflation that was seen during the Klondike Gold Rush, where prospectors became millionaires overnight, effectively, and the economy responded by what amounted to charging about $100 per single egg. It also highlights that parts of our current inflationary crisis can be linked to the simple fact that there's fewer things to buy due to supply chain breakdowns and shortages due to the dark times of the past few years. Now, if we factor all this in with the cash that's been injected into the economy before 2019 and as a response to those dark times, in just the first 12 months of the year, Canada took on $381.6 billion in new debt. TD Bank estimates that a lot of the money that was handed out over the past few years, in their words, was stashed under the mattress. Those are their words, not ours. And that Canadians were probably sitting on in excess of $300 million in excess savings, which could make inflation worse once that money works its way into the economy. And it would make things worse because the economy is, as they say, facing supply-side constraints, which means that those shortages we talked about are limiting it now, but should those constraints ease, that money will flow into the economy and potentially overheat it even more, spurring the Bank of Canada to act with more rate hikes. Now, of course, governments across the country also giving money away. The BC government is giving $600 million in tax rebates, and the Saskatchewan government just recently sent out $500 checks to each resident there. Bankers and economists say that the spending won't solve the problem, and the government thinks it will. But, as we've talked about, media reporting on this matter isn't exactly explaining how economics works, and at the end of the day, most Canadians are simply hurting and want to fix to this problem. And that's why it's so important that real, tangible solutions be presented, and why those who present them are able to cut through the media ruckus and not just open up the government checkbook and have the media repeat their press releases.
Yes, it looks like if through any large measure of the imagination that the federal government's giving out all of this money to help what they call inflation relief and to help with people buying homes and to help with the housing supply. It just goes down to the fact that they're spending more and more money on this means that they're actually creating more inflation, as there is more money out there, which is not actually buying fewer items. More money out there is buying fewer items, which means that those items cost more money to do. And as you said, with the Klondike Gold Rush, where there was such a huge demand for just basic goods, such as groceries, that couldn't be shipped up there very quickly, it meant that they were able to charge so much more because people would buy that. And nowadays, we have a much more robust supply chain than we did over 125 years ago. But the fact remains is that there's many more people in Canada now, and there's not really more goods that have been created in Canada. A lot of it has been imported, and a lot of our food comes from outside of the country. This means that all of the basic necessities and essentials that you need for day-to-day life, they're really not coming from nearby or your local area, and they're coming from far away. And the increases to taxes, the increases to things like the carbon tax, gas taxes that have all gone up, it all adds to the price of the goods that you're getting. So adding more and more money to this is not really helping the problem. And what would fix the problem would be relief for people directly. And the best way to do that is to slow inflation. And the best way to slow inflation is to not put more money from the government and from tax dollars into the economy. And I think that that's something that, as Scotiabank said, anybody that has studied economics textbooks would know that this is something that is not going to help things.
Yeah, and once again, it really underscores just how important those core understandings of economics are. And we could go on a whole discussion here about how that's needed in the education system, how that's needed in the media, and how that's even needed in the government, that the government practice sound economic policies, that the Bank of Canada implements sound monetary policies as well. And it's been a long time since Canada has had a government that has followed that has been run by an economist or two. And when the discussion starts to shift on what the federal government is doing and what the media is doing and how they're covering that, there were fireworks that erupted this week, and that's where we're headed now with our firing line.
Yes, in our firing line segment, we always talk about a story that either didn't get covered, got covered poorly, or it was just such a shocking event that happened that just needs to be talked about. And one could say that this story was all three of those. And we kind of saw it coming, in a sense, because in the week after Pierre Poilievre's leadership victory for the Conservative Party of Canada, we at Western Context were keeping a close eye on the news coverage of his landslide victory on the first ballot, just to see how the media were talking about him. Now, we weren't shocked to see a slew of biased and sensationalized articles be released in the aftermath, with the intent on setting the narrative that Poilievre is a dangerous Trump-like figure out to destroy our democracy, which was a quote from an actual article. Never mind that only 1 minute of listening to the two men speak should show that there really isn't that many similarities between the two. Now, in the run-up to the election, an opinion column from the Toronto Star was titled Pierre Poilievre's Callous Courting of Canada's Deplorables, in which the writer makes reference to what he calls the shocking and unwise words of Hillary Clinton's comments on people who were among Donald Trump's supporters back when she was running for the 2016 U.S. presidential election and failed miserably to win that. Now, even though the writer says that it was an unwise comment, he actually makes the similar appellation when referring to Poilievre, and it's just another point of hypocrisy that you see within the article that you see. Now, Bob Hepburn writes, quote, like Trump, Poilievre is potentially leading us down the same dark and nasty road that Trump has taken Americans, all in a sleazy bid to attain power, and at almost any price. Now, one can look at actual reality and see just how crazy of a statement this is to make, because, after all, Trump isn't in power anymore, and he's not leading Americans down a dark and nasty road because, well, he's not the president. And this is something that he hasn't been for a couple years now. And, well, it seems that the media is still just trying to make this comparison to the conservative leader being the same like Trump, because that's what they've done for the past 6 years or so. Now, the CBC already tried to shape the narrative in a different direction, that the majority of Poilievre's supporters were convoy donors who gave more than $460,000 to the CPC leadership race, and that many were first-time federal donors. And quite clearly, these are the deplorables that the earlier Toronto Sun or Toronto Star article was talking about. Now, but by far the most shocking event of the week was when David Akin of Global News started heckling Poilievre as he was about to give a statement. Now, Akin was upset because the newly elected conservative leader said that he wouldn't take any questions from the media after a statement. Now, the exchange became uncomfortable as the two men shot barbs at each other, with Akin shouting at him and Poilievre calling him a liberal heckler. Now, the verbal scuffle ended when Poilievre agreed to take two questions. Later on Twitter, Akin apologized for being rude and disrespectful. Even so, Poilievre used the incident, which was carried live, to raise funds in an email to Conservative Party supporters. Here's part of the email. He said, quote, first, they hurled obscenities and started shouting at me. Was it some left-wing protester? Maybe it was a Liberal MP or staffer? No, it was a member of the media. That's right, David Akin from Global News was swearing, shouting, and heckling. He wasn't interested in hearing what I had to say, and he certainly wasn't interested in reporting it in an unbiased way. Now, Akin himself, who has worked for conservative outlets such as the National Post, Sun Media, and the Sun News Network, and whose outlet receives no government funding unlike the newspapers, was branded an enemy. It's clear from Poilievre's handling of this incident that he, unlike previous leaders Scheer and O'Toole, know that the media is out to get the Conservative Party and its leaders, and to twist the news to suit their own agendas. Now, Poilievre might have been able to handle the situation more gracefully. It's clearly Akin, who is practically frothing at the mouth, who came off much worse. And yet, all of his fellow media was quick to jump to his defense and make excuses for his comments and his behavior. Now, it's true that we should expect better from our government, and that we should expect better from our government in waiting in the opposition. But we also need to expect better from our media, to actually report the news, and to not let personal emotional outbursts get in the way of what's actually going on in Canada right now.
And the interesting part about this, and the thing that was shocking to see, and that the media never talked about, is that especially over the past 2 years, and very much so during election campaigns, the Trudeau government would do the exact same thing in choosing the two questions that individual journalistic outlets would be able to ask, even so much as so as curating who could be on the phone line for the call-in questions before those press conferences were due to begin. And that's why everybody, of course, remembers, and why the media always talked about when Justin Trudeau would come out of his house and talk to the media for sometimes an hour plus some people just reported on what was talked about, but what people really, really do not know is that those questions were curated just like these questions were going to be curated here today by the Polyev camp. And this is something that's been going on for years and years in Canadian media political reporting that a lot of people don't know about. And once again, this is just underscoring how important it is for a government leader, for an opposition leader too, and a new one at that, to be able to control the narrative when it comes to their own press conferences. If you're not going to be able to control the narrative, you're not going to win. It's as simple as that. That's how it works in 2022. You can use whatever methods you want to control the narrative. You can use social media if you want. You can use press conferences. You can use direct interviews. You can use your surrogates out there in terms of your parliamentary team supporting you. You can use whichever methods you want. But if you're not controlling the media cycle, you're not going to win. And that's something that we noticed since very, very early on, January, February this year, and through the entire Conservative leadership race, that this was something that was majorly different with Pierre Poilievre as now opposition leader, is that he is able to set that narrative. He's done a pretty good job this first week. We'll have to wait and see if that continues as we head into the session and as we get closer to the next inevitable election, but this is something that the media is going to need to learn to deal with, and they're going to be put on the defensive, and they're going to be made more uncomfortable because of that, because it's been a long time since a Conservative Party leader has been able to do this, and as a result, it's going to provide a different angle of discussion in the media in this country.
Yes, exactly. And I think that one has to look at what the media coverage is on Poilievre just in the first week. And really, you know, they have to read between the lines and see what the media is actually talking about. The fact that we're seeing such articles out there that he's a very dangerous Trump-like figure that's going to ruin our democracy and take us down a dark, nasty road. As he's in opposition, he's not in government, which means he can't actually create policy. He can only oppose what the government is doing, and oppose what the government is doing is what he's trying to do with the stopping of the just inflation, as he says, and this is what he's talking about. So with the media, they're trying to get their quotes, they're trying to get their stories so that they can get their clicks and views and likes and therefore more money. So in doing so, they're trying to create a controversy that isn't really there. But at the end of the day, it's the government that sets the policy, and they're the ones that should be held to account more strongly than what the opposition leader is doing, because the government is the one that's actually in control, and the prime minister is the one who actually sets the goal and the agenda for how they're going to follow. So a lot of things that were happening this week weren't really talking about what the inflation relief package, as it were, from Trudeau, but instead they were talking about this reporter going after Pierre Poilievre. And in doing so, they actually mentioned that this story actually overshadowed another one, which was that Jean Charest, who was the failed runner-up candidate in the Conservative leadership race, is going back to the private sector. Now, given that he came to the Conservative leadership race straight from Huawei, where he was running as a consultant, one has to wonder if Jean Charest is going back to Huawei to work again as a consultant, and or if he's doing something else entirely. And it was noted that one of the MPs from Quebec that supported Jean Charest ended up leaving the party and decided to sit as an independent. But no one really talked about that much because they were all talking about how this journalist was yelling at Poilievre instead of talking about what's actually going on in the country or what the government is doing. So it's interesting to see how this story kind of overshadowed a lot of others. When quite clearly we know for a fact that there's a lot more happening in Canada than just the funeral of the queen or, you know, of a journalist that's yelling at an opposition leader.
And what we just said there underscores why this is going to be different. Because in a different era, had this been Andrew Scherer, Aaron O'Toole, the discussion would have been, what is the runner-up doing? What is the single MP who is upset with the result doing? And how is that going to throw off the agenda of the new leader? That would have been the conversation under Andrew Scherer, Aaron O'Toole. But as we're seeing, that's not the conversation here under Pierre Poilievre. The discussion has remained focused on what's happening with the economy. And when that was tried to be taken off the beaten path, we have this story here where the opposition leader did what he had to do to bring it back in control. And that's why it's going to be different this time around. And this is what we've been watching since January or February of this year. And a lot of the media still seems surprised about that. We're not. And that's precisely why we're here at Western Context. And with that, I think we can move on to our word of the week.
Yes, our word of the week this week is heckler, which saw a lot of use this week in regarding to what David Akin did during the press conference that Pierre Poilievre held. And, well, heckler, for those who don't know, is a person who interrupts a performer or public speaker with derisive or aggressive comments or abuse. And while the liberal part of the statement that Poilievre called Akin may be under question, it was indeed a heckler that Akin was being. And that's why it's interesting to note that a lot of people were taking issue with the liberal heckler comment from Poilievre when at least half of it was true.
And once again, this underscores the ability to control the media narrative. The discussion is on whether or not he is a liberal heckler. The idea is that he's a heckler confirmed based on what was said. Of course, we know that David Akin is a professional journalist, but the question that was happening was, is this a liberal heckler or is it not a liberal heckler? But it once again underscores that the point was heckler, and that's once again directing the media coverage. And this is yet another lesson in terms of why we're seeing a different opposition in this country. And we'll continue to point these things out as we see them in the media, as we need to do firing lines on them, we need to do stories on them. You'll be able to find all that and more at westerncontext.ca in our full show notes. You can also subscribe to the podcast on any number of podcast listeners out there. We're on Apple Podcasts, Google, Pocket Casts, Spotify, and more. Just visit westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And of course, we're also on Twitter and Facebook, where you can find our shows and some of the stories that we look at throughout the entire week at Western Context. So with that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.
I will be sure to look through all the stories that the mainstream media is talking about and a lot that they aren't talking about in describing what the news is of the week and why it matters to Canadians. So whether we'll find them in TV, radio, print, or online, we'll find them and we'll give you the context needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. So with that said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.